Hello and welcome to the Interior Design Business. My name is Jeff Hayward and I'm here today with my co-host, Susie Rumbold, Creative Director of Tessuto Interiors and a past President of the British Institute of Interior Design, to explore the roles and responsibilities of interior designers.
Interior designers complain bitterly that theirs is the most misunderstood profession in the world. We undertake complex, highly skilled technical work within a framework of building safety regulations and consumer protection legislation. And yet we're still only credited for our good taste and our ability to shop. But are we our own worst enemies? Is some of the confusion being caused by the designers themselves? And if this is the case, how do we sharpen up our act, disabuse the public of this perception, and command the respect we think we deserve? Welcome to the Interior Design Business.
We are here at the London offices of LXA and delighted to have with us Sami Bakulis, Associate Designer at LXA, and Liz Bell, Director at Absolute Project Management and President-elect of the British Institute for Interior Design. Welcome to you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So before we begin, can you please tell me a bit about your background in interior design? Sami, would you like to go first?
Yeah. So I studied to be an architect. So my career starts 20 years ago, whereas working in an architectural practice, two of them actually, from one-off houses to big settlements, residential settlements in Kent. But my passion for interior design just couldn't be put to the side. So eventually, in my previous office that I was working for as an architect, I started slowly kind of building a smaller section into the office for interior design, and I realized that this is it, this is what I should be doing, and I took the big step and I met LXA, and they were lovely and they invited me, and we've been working together for the last just over a year now.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
And Liz, what about you?
So actually, I come from an architecture background as well. I did part one RABA architecture degree. And then I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So I went traveling for 3 years and then came back thinking, oh my God, I really need to start a career. And looked at anything to do with the construction industry because it still did really intrigue me. And I ended up working for Absolute Project Management. And I worked there for 10 years. And became, I think, a registered designer in 2019, joined the BIID on the professional practice committee and then the sustainability committee. And obviously my career's progressed at Absolute and I took over the business last summer and I'm president-elect. So yeah, it's just carried on going.
Before we move on, Sami, aren't you involved on the BIID committees too?
I am. I'm a volunteer for the professional practice committee as well. And I do a lot of volunteering, trying to help new, especially registered members of the BIID with questions that have to do with anything really that involve interior design and contracts and business and clients.
So you are a very good person to be having this talk with today.
I try and help them because you do feel the pain, and when they do make that phone call, you do hear the fear in them. So I try to, you know, direct them as much as I can, basically.
Right, good. So on to the questions then. What do the public at large think that interior designers actually do, and what's given them this impression? Liz, do you want to start with that one?
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, we could talk about TV and social media. I guess a lot of the programmes, I'd say like 99% of the programmes that are out there show, you know, people working on, say, like one room in a really quick time frame and like maybe DIYing something. And, you know, I don't want to disparage that because I think there's value in those videos and it gets people interested. But actually, that's such a niche, small part of what most interior designers do that I find that quite annoying, to be honest. You know, I think it gives the wrong impression about what we do, the value in it, and, you know, what the fees might be. Because if you're thinking, oh, I need an interior designer, and you're expecting them to turn up with a paintbrush themselves and like show you hundreds of samples off the bat, you know, that's just so that just doesn't really happen. So I think that's a big problem. And I think there's also a communication gap. You know, there's so many different designers out there. Everyone works in slightly different ways. Everyone might charge slightly different ways. And actually, if you are looking to hire an interior designer and get a quote, it's really difficult to compare them because you don't, you know, the services are different, the quotes are different. You know, if you've got no experience of the industry, it's really hard to know what it is that you're looking for and who's going to be the right fit. Yeah. So I think, yeah, there's a few things that make it really tough for people to understand.
Sammy, anything that you'd add?
I think there's a confusion between interior decorators and interior designer and what each mean. And I remember talking to my mom. I said, you know, it's interior design that I want to do. And she's like, what about architecture? You know, it's like that fear that the term architect is so well recognized and what it comes with and what it entails.
Prestigious, indeed.
It is, isn't it? Whereas interior designer, people are like, are you a decorator? What do you actually design? And so there's a misconception about those two. And I think what we do is interior design, which has to do with a lot of services and electricals and mechanics and how do things work together. And we overlay drawings from different subconsultants that we make sure that everything aligns. And if you move a bathroom, actually can be moved there because there are services. So it's not just what colors are going to be, what wallpaper is going to be. It's much, much, much more than that.
So you think that the public actually understand architects better than interior designers?
For sure. I think it's a profession that it's been explained and it's been talked about much more than interior design. And there's a vast majority understand what architecture entails. And interior design is the TV shows that I think I agree. They add this confusion. And it's also about clients don't really understand what they actually need. Like if we're talking about their houses, for example, they don't understand that if they're doing an extension, for example, they could still involve an interior designer who would give the right advice for it. It doesn't immediately mean they need an architect. So I think what would help is for interior designs, I'm speaking, like when they send out a quote, as you were mentioning before, is a scope of works. And even following RBA stages helps. Mm. And for each stage to kind of spell out what is that as an interior designer being
there. So what the designer would do within each of those stages.
In these stages.
Some designers try to get around the issue of the confusion with the names and to try and give themselves a bit more gravitas, I think, by calling themselves architectural interior designers. Does that help or does it just further muddy the waters, Liz?
I mean, I think that can be dangerous territory because in the UK, the term, what the profession architect is a protected title, so that it's a criminal offence to call yourself an architect in the UK unless you are registered with the ARB, the Architects Registration Board. And, you know, they're not going to prosecute a software architect because it's very clear that that's a different sector entirely. But I think for an interior designer who is working, you know, very closely in the construction industry, I think you can get yourself into a lot of trouble if you start calling yourself an interior architect and you're not registered. So I think that doesn't really help. I think one of my bugbears is that many architects actually say, oh, we can do the interiors, but they don't necessarily mean they're going to do it to the same level that an interior designer would, because either that's not what they do or it's not part of their scope or they're actually not that interested in it. And all of those reasons are fine, but that's where actually it should be. They should make it much clearer what they do, and maybe interior designers can make it much clearer what they do and they can add on or bring to the table instead of or as well as an architect. So I think, you know, we need to, as an industry, better separate those things and probably work together, architects and interior designers, to make it clearer for consumers and for clients.
Yeah, we often say that interior designers, architects work from the outside in and interior designers work from the inside out.
Yeah,
there's a point somewhere there where they meet.
But there's no real separation at the same time. It's so difficult to delineate the two. And I think interior design is a terminology that has been used for years and years and years now. To change it now is going to add, I think, more confusion. Mm-hmm. Whereas if we try and clarify it, then it might give more gravitas to it and people will understand more about it.
Okay. Yeah. Here's your chance then, Sammy. Clarify it. What does an interior designer do and what services do they offer?
So it's, you know, it will start from, let's say it's a house that it's a domestic job and they're looking into, for example, an extension. You know, they will advise on the works that need to be done for the extension. They might advise for a structural engineer. They might advise for an architect to be involved to do the planning drawings and do all the right things to get the permission and all that. So they have a knowledge of how the system works. Mm-hmm. And then when you look at the building itself, they have an understanding of services. They have an understanding of where solvent pipes are, where electrics are, where you need more mechanical ventilation, for example. They understand building regulations. They can advise on that. They, you know, we've got new parts in building regulations coming in, like Part O. We constantly do CPDs to educate ourselves, and we are keeping up to date with all these things. And then slowly, eventually, you know, you come into the finishes, and then it comes into technical detail of the finish. You know, is it a wet room? Do you need slip resistance? And what slip resistance? You know, it's not just it's going to be red, it's going to be blue. It's all that comes with it, and the knowledge that comes with it, that the client can just rest assured that they're going to get a product that is going to, you know, be there for a lifetime, and it would work as should be working,
and meets their requirements.
And meets their requirements.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I mean, our role in most of our projects is that we help the clients develop their vision or their brief right from the start. So they'll come and they might say, oh, we want to do an extension or we want to renovate inside. We're not really quite sure how to do it. And the benefit of using interior designers, I would say, in that kind of scenario is that we can write down what their brief is. Right from the start, we do a budget and timeline so we know, you know, roughly what we've got to spend and how feasible it is. And then once we've got that concept, we've got that design goal, we can then carry that through right to the end. So we can engage other specialists if we need them. We can make sure it adheres to regulation. We can make sure they've got planning permission. And then we can also do all the really beautiful bits that actually really bring that together. So I think that's the value that... Well, we certainly bring on our projects. And I think that's where, you know, if you start with another specialist, things can get a little bit muddied and a bit trickier to sort of, you know, bring everyone together. So it's good to have, you know, at least one or two specialists that are sort of guiding and agree on the end goal.
Mm. Confusingly, most interior designers act both professionally and commercially when they work for their clients. In practice, what does that actually mean? Sammy, can you clarify that for us?
Professionally is the services we provide to do with drawings, with specifications, with special arrangement, with getting sub-consultants and coordinating the work. Commercially, it's basically acting as a retailer to the client. And there's a completely different, it's a different assurances for each.
Sort of like selling stuff.
It's selling, basically selling stuff. And I don't know about, but we don't really do that. We don't really take that role. We act as an agent where we advise our clients, but we never retail or sell things. And I would never really want to do that because there are more specialists in the field that they can do that.
So just clarify that for me. So you could specify a product, but you can't actually sell it in that role as a professional specifier? How's that work?
So say on a residential project, you have designed this beautiful space and you've suggested maybe three sofas and the client's chosen one of them. And maybe you can get a trade discount and you say, I'll get you a trade discount and I'll, you know, sell it on to you. So the professional part is where you did the design and where you, you know, suggested a few options and they chose and blah, 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 and that's fine. That's all professional. But once you start buying things and selling it to the client or passing on discounts and this, that and the other, that's where you're acting commercially. And then there's a little bit of conflict of interest there because you know, if you've suggested three sofas and one's really expensive, when you get to the commercial side, you're going to want them to choose the really expensive one because you're going to make more money on that, either through your selling it on, or you might get a bigger trade discount that you don't pass on. So there's lots of different ways of doing that. And I think that's where some of the distrust in our industry kind of comes from, because people don't know, you know, how much people are making on procurement, if they're passing on trade discounts, if they're not, if they're incentivized to only offer really expensive sofas because they want the money, or if they think it's the better design. So,
and presumably clients might insist on you passing on a trade discount, or they might think that they could call themselves an interior designer and get the trade discount themselves.
Yeah, I mean, the way we operate, we operate again as an agent, so we don't purchase anything and then sell it on. We're not a retailer. And any trade discounts that we do get, we pass on directly. So again, we're trying to demonstrate that we're not incentivized by, you know, being paid, and we would only suggest things because we think they're actually good for that space. And I think, I mean, most designers, I think, do act with integrity. So yeah, I think it's really important for your reputation that you are choosing things because you think it's the right design, because, you know, you're going to get photos of that space. You're going to want to show it. You're not going to want your clients to think that you've only suggested something because you're going to make an extra £100 on it. You know, I think it is really important to clients, but unless you're being really transparent about the process and about how you charge, you know, people might think that you're not being, that you're being disingenuous.
So how do you go about getting paid for the time that you're spending then picking up those, or not just picking up, but, you know, designing and specifying those pieces of furniture?
Yeah. The way that we work, we charge hourly for all of our design work. So that's almost like separate. That's any design work, any sourcing, gathering quotes, anything like that, we charge hourly. And we'll do a really detailed proposal at the start of the works where we estimate each stage, each item, and then clients can say, yep, go ahead with sourcing, go ahead with colours, go ahead with whatever. Or, you know, they can say, actually, I'm going to deal with sourcing the sofa. You don't have to spend time on that. I personally like that way of working because I think it demonstrates the value in what you're doing. And it also means that you're being really transparent about the process and your fee for that portion.
So it's about being super clear with whether you're an agent, whether you're a retailer,
correct,
whether you're a designer. So you're really bringing three functions into the same role as an interior designer.
Yeah. And I mean, that's where people can get really tripped up as well, because if you have three quotes from an interior designer and one saying, oh, I'll do the design for free and, you know, and then we'll supply things to you, actually they're going to get all their money on the supplying, and then it kind of devalues the design portion against the other two designers that might have a really high fee for that, and then what looks like a low fee for the it's really hard to compare. And then I think, you know, from my point of view as someone who would be giving a high estimation for the design portion, that it makes me look unbelievably expensive, but then I might be much cheaper in the long run because I pass on any trade discount.
Design is not free.
No, design isn't free. But I think historically a lot of designers did operate on that retailing model. You know, they literally, they did the design for free and then sold stuff to their clients and took the discounts, or put markup on things, and weren't particularly transparent about what they were charging and how much hidden markup was in there. I think a lot of that's gone away because of the internet. You know, people can find out these days how much things cost.
Exactly. So does your practice work the same way, Sammy?
I was going to say, transparency for me is the number one. And we separate even the contracts. So we've got one contract for design and we've got one contract for procurement. So even if we end up acting as a retailer, which we don't usually do, but we do help the clients with procurement. So we do organize all the lead times, and we organize the supply and the installation and all that. But it's all paid by the client. So we're not acting really as a... But still, we separate that contract. So the client knows that this is a portion of the design, this is what the scope of works is, this is how much you're going to be paying us. And then when the procurement comes and the FF&E comes in, we even have different people in our office that deal with this. So it couldn't be any clearer to the client. And we always say, you know, we can provide you design and we can provide the procurement. You choose what you want to do, which, you know, part of the business would you like to involve?
I want to be really clear about what it means to act as an agent versus acting as a principal, i.e. a retailer. So have either of you have a succinct definition that you could perhaps share with our listeners?
I'm happy to give it a go.
Yep.
Go on.
So whenever we get or whenever we procure things for our clients, we would get any quote in their name. And all of our emails to that supplier, again, we say at the bottom in our signature, like we're acting as the agent on behalf of the client. So again, that's really clear for the client and the retailer. And then we pass on all the quotes, any T's and C's, things that they need to be aware of, because, you know, they need to be aware of that as the consumer. You couldn't give them something and then say, oh, it's your problem. Oh, we didn't send you the T's and C's, you know. We want to be really, really clear that they are responsible for this purchase, and we might even send them a list of things to check before they buy, like, are you happy with the size? Is that the right colour? Is this the right thing? Blah, blah, blah. Even though we will have checked those details, it's really important that the client has in their mind, I'm responsible to say yes for this. And then we also get them to actually pay direct most of the time, particularly for big items. We just don't want to be... We don't want to have any part in that if it's, you know, a big ticket item. Because if it went wrong, if, again, say a sofa, it's a 10K sofa, if something's wrong with it or the client doesn't like it or it breaks and they want to send it back, if you are the retailer, it's your responsibility to deal with it.
Got it.
And obviously, you know, we have good relationships with manufacturers, with the original supplier, and we can try and levy those relationships to get a good result, to get them to fix it, to get them to replace it, whatever. But ultimately, if those suppliers or manufacturers say no, I'm not dealing with it, then you are going to be responsible as the person who sold it on.
Yeah.
And that's what I just don't want to be part of.
No.
So it's not enough then for a designer to just say we'll be acting as your agent.
No, I think you would get into a really tricky position, especially with your professional indemnity insurance, because that covers your professional side, i.e. the designs. It wouldn't cover you for being a retailer.
Mm.
Yeah.
But as always, I think most interior designers, we act with such transparency that even if we're not the retailers and we're just the agents, we would always try and rectify things. And we'll always, because we've, as you mentioned, we've got a relationship with the manufacturers. They want to work with us again. We want to work with them. So my experience has been only positive, where, you know, things do go wrong. And although I specify the stool, which I was told that is going to be fit for purpose for a commercial project, it failed. It just started coming apart within the 2 weeks. You know, I was on the phone to the manufacturer. They came around. We both looked at it. We found a solution how we can rectify that. They came the next day. They fixed it. And now we're monitoring to see how it's going to perform. So it's not that we left the client to deal with it. Although, legally, I could have just said, I told you what it needs to be done, to do, to how to perform. You haven't provided me with the right, you know, object. Just replace it. But... you know, what's the point? You want to provide the best service for the client and you want them to be happy.
You want to act professional.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
If you are doing a big project for a client and you might have hundreds of items that need to be procured, and if it's, and you're acting as their agent, if they have to be responsible for the payments, mm-hmm. are clients willing to do that? Or is it too much? Do you ever run across problems where the client goes, look, I really haven't got time to be making 75 transfers into various... to pay for items?
I never personally had that issue. And we also do interior design for schools. We do a lot of the education, where you can imagine we've got multiples of the same desk, the same chair, storage. It's just you take them through the process and you involve them at an early stage where they can just... they can review an item at a time is just not overload them with information. And I think that's a journey as interior designers that we take the clients. And with schools, we involve the head teachers, we involve whoever needs to be involved. We bring samples, we test them together, we bring maybe even students to test them. And then we start signing off the products that have been approved. And again, not trying to overload the client with information. We do it step by step, basically. But
bite-sized chunks.
Yeah, but we never really had an issue with that.
Is that ever a problem? Have you ever come across?
You know, occasionally we will take the risk and we might purchase those for them, but I wouldn't do it for any large items. And I mean, we kind of, I think as designers, you take a bit of a risk anyway, even if they are procuring it, you would, I'm sure the client would expect you and I would expect to be involved in rectifying something if it went wrong, whether it was something that was really small that I procured or if it was something really big that they paid direct, I would still be involved in that.
Mm.
But I think you have to be mindful of the risk. You know, I wouldn't mind paying for a £20 hinge. I would mind paying for a £20,000 sofa.
What about you, Susie? Have you ever had that issue where the client said, I'm not doing this, can you do it for me?
Yeah, it happens. And I think the other, I have, and then you're right, you're then in this awful position where you are suddenly finding yourself inadvertently acting as a retailer when you didn't think you were going to. Mm. And the other time when it crops up is when you're doing something, again, sofa is a great example, where you have multiple things. You've got a fabric, you might have a separate trim, you might have a piping as well. So, you know, you've got stuff coming from, and some of it has to be fireproofed. So you might be managing lots of different components of that to be then sent to the sofa manufacturer to then eventually have the thing delivered to site and fingers crossed that it all comes out right in the end. And so that becomes very difficult for the clients to kind of manage those sorts of payments too. And these people, generally speaking, are time poor.
Yeah.
So it's not straightforward. And unfortunately, the law is really not clear. Mm. The law is really not clear on this stuff. So, you know, you just have to proceed with caution, I think.
And Liz, what sort of additional protection does a private client have versus a commercial client?
So private clients, you know, they are individuals, they're not working through a company, they're not paying through a company. They have all the consumer rights, so the Consumer Rights Act of 2015. So there's lots of protections there for consumers about, you know, repair or replacement, you can return it in 30 days. Price reductions, lots of things. So I've got a little note here. The Act outlines standards that goods must be met, including satisfactory quality, fit for purpose as described, etc. So they've got a lot more sort of protections than a commercial client. But then commercial clients might want to do it that way for tax reasons or, you know, for many different reasons. So
a private client might well try to manage a contract through their commercial business.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I would say for any designers that have been asked by their client, whether commercial or private, you know, if they've said, oh, we want to do it a certain way or we want to pay this way, I would just check that you're comfortable with that. Check the Consumer Rights Act, check that your insurance covers you for all the sorts of questions that might, you know, bring up if something goes wrong.
What if the project is something like a buy-to-let property? Is that a commercial? Does that become a commercial project, or
It does. And then there's a different contract to sign for that. So that as an interior designer, you should be aware of the different forms of contract. For example, for that situation, you can go to Concise, interior designer contract for the IRBA and BID, which is for not complex commercial projects. If it's a complex commercial project, then you go to the Concise IRBA building contract. So again, you have to be educated as an interior designer about the different forms of contract and which one you should be signing with your client.
So you just have to understand what it is you're doing. Yeah.
Close by close, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah, if you're asked to do anything out that you don't normally do, you should always do research before saying yes. And actually the BIID have, if you are a member, they have a really good legal helpline and each member gets 30 minutes of consultation a year. So if you've got any questions like that, then It's great to be a BIID member.
I'm sure I know the answer to this question. Are consumer clients ever at all disingenuous with how they are dealing with you or wish to transact with you?
I think every client can be tricky. I mean, I've not actually worked with a consumer client or a client who's tried to pay that way, so I've not experienced any issues with that. But certainly, as someone in what I would call a service industry, I've had tricky clients.
For other reasons, maybe. Well,
yeah. Again, I don't deal with consumer clients. It's more commercial clients I deal with. So no issues there just because I haven't dealt with. But I can imagine that I can easily see this. That a client tried to say that, oh, I'm going to pay you through my company, through my limited company for, you know, tax reasons or whatever they might be. And that's where you should, as you mentioned, do your research and be prepared. Yeah. And don't hold back. Just be, you know, direct and protect your position at any case.
Susie, have that happened to you?
Well, I was just thinking, in theory, if you've got a consumer client and they are genuinely a consumer client and you're selling them stuff, you're retailing to them, they can turn around and say, no, don't like it, take it away. And what do you do then if you've put 25 yards of or 25 metres of expensive fabric on an enormous corner sofa group, you know, and had the whole thing bespoke made? Because no one's going to take that back.
No.
Yeah.
So I do think clients sometimes can be disingenuous in their dealings. Sometimes they're more informed about their rights than perhaps the designer that they're employing.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think it is really important to protect yourself and protect your business, particularly when you're doing proposals. So making sure that you're paid, you know, up front for design work, making sure that you're paid regularly, making sure that if you are retailing, maybe you take deposits, you take, you know, parts of the fees. And I think, you know, being really careful about how you manage relationships. And obviously we want all our clients to love our work and we want to have great relationships, but the world isn't like that. And so I think actually preparing for the worst is probably a sensible thing to do. And I don't think many clients would be upset by that. It makes good business sense and you can explain that to people. We tend to get weekly payments for our design, well, for all the stages, design and on site. And we've had clients say, you know, oh, it's too much for me to pay you weekly. Can I just pay you monthly? And we just say flat no. You know, we're a small business. We need cash flow. It has to be this way. And actually, they've all just gone, okay, then. And paid. So actually, you know, you stand firm, hold your ground, explain why, because that is important for people to understand. And then so far it's been okay.
Great stuff.
It's in the same way as you were saying that, you know, a contract, when you sign a contract with a client, you need to go through line by line with the client to understand what they're getting into.
That's part of the consumer rights legislation, isn't it? That you have to negotiate.
It says that you have to negotiate and go through line by line. And it's the same thing, I think, that comes back to transparency with clients, is that when you do your scope, when you draw your scope of works and you have your first initial meetings with a client, is have a cash flow chart where you can tell them exactly when and where they should expect money to go and to pay the services. And it's hard to argue afterwards with that when you've been clear about it and transparent and you've presented that from the start to the client.
Interior designers, Liz, will swear blind that they never take on building work, but are there any circumstances at all where they might be unwittingly acting as a contractor?
Yeah, I mean, I would say at the end, if you're unpackaging furniture, you're hanging curtains, you're plumping cushions, you're, you know, making it look great at the end, actually I think you would start to be a contractor, I think. And that's when you have to start thinking about health and safety, who else is on site, are you able to carry something over? You know, if you've got a team of people and someone's got a slight back issue, they pick up something heavy and move it, you know, you could get into a lot of trouble because you've told them that they need to move something. So yeah, I mean, we don't do it. we get our contractors to unpack, but you still need to think about, you know, the practicalities of that. Are they being paid for their time? Are they dealing with the rubbish? Who's getting rid of the, or the plastic packaging? Who's getting rid of the cardboard? So even if you're not the contractor, you're not taking that role on, I think as the designer, you have got some responsibility there to the people that you're employing to do that part of the work.
And I think most clients who would be watching interior design TV shows would think, well, interior designers do all of that.
Yeah, no, they don't. Anything that I have to get a sweat on, I'm like, we have excellent contractors.
Yes, we've got a principal contractor that can do all that.
Yeah, exactly. So long as it's the principal contractor, though, if it gets to the end of the project and the contractor is pulled off and you're then going in, so the building contract is completed, you as the designer are now going in and you might be hanging paintings, you might be putting up curtain tracks, you might be putting up shelves. You might be putting in, I don't know, loo roll holders if the contractor hasn't done those bits. There could be any manner of kind of inadvertently sort of buildery bits left over at the end of the job. And if you've organised your team to go in and do that work, you're a contractor. Clients have to take on board that role of principal contractor. So there's building regs, but there's also construction design management, CDM. The client has to take on the role of principal designer unless they appoint somebody else to be principal designer. And then, of course, there's a principal contractor role. Mm. And these bits at the end of a project on a big project can constitute hundreds of hours of work.
Yeah.
But then again, there I would suggest or advise is to know inside out the contract you've got with the principal contractor. And there's always a 12-month defects period. And if you've got everything specified and is within the contract, then they should be coming back to do those works.
So your advice would be to make sure that all those last bits and bobs go into the main building contract.
Yes.
That the designer does not then have his or her own team of people that go in and do that last, those bits.
Now we'll specify the artwork and we'll have it into the specs. We'll specify the ruler holder. We'll specify the toilet brush. We'll specify absolutely everything. And I know that commonly forget about this thing because they are probably in a storeroom at the back and they haven't even seen it. But we, you know, I would call them and say, it's in your contract, you have to come back and put this up. And luckily I didn't have to do it myself.
The truth is, though, that I think a lot of designers don't work that way. They have their own teams of people to come and do these last bits at the end.
Yeah, but what you're opening yourself up to if you do that potentially a whole world of pain.
Mm.
Yeah, if you're not aware of, you know, health and safety rules and you're not aware of your responsibilities as an employer, then, you know, you can get into a lot of trouble if accidents occur. I mean, I don't want to be like the, you must think about everything, the worst could happen. But actually, by thinking about what the worst thing that could happen is, then you can protect yourself. You can take steps to avoid the worst happening. And that actually is the whole point of health and safety. I know people find it really boring and really like, oh God, but the whole point is that you want people to be healthy and safe.
Yeah.
And actually, there's a lot of value in that.
And as designers, we're all supposed to be trying to design out risk. That's a key part of our job. Yeah. I mean, I think you put it beautifully earlier when you said that you plan for the, hope for the best, but plan for the worst.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's what risk registers are. And, you know, a principal CDM designer will be doing that where they're going to be going around and think about the absolute worst that can happen. Getting up on a ladder, installing a window or whatever it might be, they always think what's the worst case scenario for that and what's the risk, what's the level of risk, and then how do you overcome that risk by planning ahead? This is the whole concept of it anyway.
So interior designers who are doing those last bits of construction work with themselves, building work, should have a risk register then, by implication.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, and I think, and actually, another thing to be aware of and to be empowered to do, when you go on site, like at any stage of the work, if you see something unsafe, you can say to the contractor, can you move that? Can you pick that up? Can you make sure that I can see that person's not wearing a hard hat, or I can see that they're drilling and they've not got goggles on. And, you know, they might roll their eyes, but actually you've done the right thing by pointing that out and trying to keep everyone safe. And, you know, they might roll their eyes, but actually I'd like to think that they think, oh, we care. They care about me. And maybe I will put some goggles on. So, you know, I think people should feel empowered to do that because A, it's important as a human being, and B, it is actually really professionally important that you are looking at those things and making a note of them. So like site meetings, we always have right at the start, any current risks on site, any risks for upcoming work, any hazards noticed, and we write them every week, and often they're the same, but you know, I try to refresh it.
Any accidents, and you have to register all the accidents, and hopefully every time they're going to say no accidents, ends all good. But you need to be prepared for these things.
Yeah, absolutely. So then, the final question: why would anyone want to be an interior designer?
I knew this was coming. Where
are my notes? I forget.
Sammy, do you want to kick that one up?
Well, I just couldn't keep myself away from it, to be honest with you. It's just so much fun. It's such a fast-paced profession. And for me, comparing architecture with interior design, you know, I used to work on projects that would go on for years and years and years. Interior design, we're talking about, I've had projects that have been on site for 8 weeks and that was it and done. And it's just that adrenaline and going on site and constantly checking and giving solutions with a contractor and seeing something taking shape so, so quickly. You know, you enter a space, it's an empty shell, and then design starts happening and how you've shaped the space to work for a specific reason. It's just, there's no other feeling when you see a project finished, it's successful, and the client is happy with it. I wouldn't change for the world. It's just...
Despite all the hates.
Do you forget everything?
Whereas for Liz, she's obviously a huge fan of CDM regulations.
Of course, yeah. I just live for spreadsheets. Well, I mean, I'm joking, but I do quite like a spreadsheet now. So, you know, I think I really like the versatility of the role. Of course, I love the design. I love knowing that a client loves their new space. I want it to function well. I want it to be inherently good. And I think, you know, there's so much that you can do. But also, I like it once I've solved the problems. But it's nice to have a challenge. It's nice to have to work with people. It's, you know, it can be really rewarding when you've had this big issue and then you've solved it and everyone's really pleased.
Mm. Fantastic. Thanks so much. That's brilliant. Really enjoyed that conversation. You've made such a dry subject feel so interesting. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
It's been fantastic. Well, that was amazing, guys. Thank you so much for your time today. That's just been wonderful. And I hope it, for the people that you listen to the episode, it's helped to clarify some of the confusion surrounding some of aspects of our profession. It's been a brilliant conversation and thank you so much.
Yes, excellent conversation. Thank you again so, so much. And we do hope you've enjoyed this episode. Please do check us out on our social channels at Interior Design Business Pod and please share any feedback that you have. The Interior Design Business is a Wildwood Plus production.